Welcome back to New Persuasive Words. I'm Scott Jones.
And I'm Bill Bohr.
And we're recording on a Saturday, which we almost never do.
Yeah, we usually take a Shabbat away from each other.
Exactly. But you needed my comfort because you just wrestled with a 14-foot tree.
We put a 14-foot Christmas tree in front of our church. The best plan, laid plans of mice and men, but we've got it up. We got her up. So we'll see what happens.
I'll tell you, we'll see how the podcast goes, but I like the Saturday recording. I feel like I got a lot done around the house. I feel like I'm in my zone reflectively.
Yeah, I'm recovering from Thanksgiving. I was working this morning, so doing some stuff, both for sermon and for consulting. So I was busy today as well.
You're a force to be reckoned with.
I am something.
And of course, Fidel Castro has passed. And
right.
Yeah. One of our listeners thought we would be especially brokenhearted by that.
Yeah, well.
Do you know Cuba de Libra downtown? It's near Rittenhouse.
Yeah, I've been there. Yeah,
on December 4th, they're offering free drinks, free rum and coke during happy hour, during Castro's funeral.
So these would be the Cubans that were not happy with him.
Yeah, so I don't know what you're doing on December 4th.
Rum and coke. If it was mojitos, I might actually.
They have great mojitos.
Yeah, it's a fun place, particularly when it's warm and it's all open and everything.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
But, we could talk about the fact that Billy Bush is working again, reportedly. He's going to have a job with Breitbart Media.
Yeah, the universe just keeps getting better.
Yeah, hey. Media, we're making media great again.
Oh, my goodness. My goodness.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. But
sponsored by Tic Tacs, Breitbart Media, sponsored by
Tic Tacs. Yeah.
The 1.5 calorie.
By the way, I wish you all tomorrow's the first Sunday of Advent. So happy new year from the church calendar. And Scott, you have launched a new podcast that is looking at the lectionary.
Yeah. It's called Same Old Song, and I attribute that name to Jacob Smith, came up with it, who I do the podcast with. And yeah, it's fun. It's us wrestling with the passages under 25 minutes or less.
There we go.
So it's one of the few podcasts I've actually put a time limit on.
So if you have not prepared your sermon for Advent 1, shame on you, number one.
Okay. Shame.
Shame. Shame. Shame. Yeah. Now, none of you were that busy that you could not work on the sermon before tonight. But if you did that, check out their podcast, and you can totally rip off their ideas.
Exactly. That's what it's there for. But we're actually going to talk about metaphysics.
There we go. Yeah. I love talking about metaphysics. Matter of fact, since the election, I'm maybe purely going to escape into the metaphysical realm.
Exactly.
I told you, we actually recorded this once, and it didn't quite work out. And as I was leaving your house, I said, I'm going and getting my copy of Plotinus. That makes me feel... You know,
Plotinus, that's your safe space?
That's going to be my safe space for the next 4 years.
You know, it's interesting. I'm going to stop. I promise.
All right.
But so Donald Trump said the theater should be a safe space. Like when the cast of Hamilton...
Right, no, I know the reference.
Vic Pence. I thought, like, of all the people, so... If you voted for Donald Trump as a protest vote for political correctness, the culture of censorious political correctness, he is imploring us to have safe spaces, which I didn't think I would hear Donald Trump be an advocate of the safe space.
That's right. Maybe he needs a puppy and some Play-Doh to get over.
He could.
Anyway, this was in part inspired by a recent interview you did with... who we think is the greatest living theologian, Robert Jensen.
Absolutely. The great Robert Jensen. Just unbelievable.
And he had an interesting quote or an interesting statement that I think is worth repeating.
In the interview about revisionist. Yeah. He basically said something to the effect, right, that revisionist metaphysics was the most important or one of the most important projects the church could undertake. That the church learning to interpret reality from the interior rationality of the gospel itself, as opposed to external frameworks, to borrowing too much from external frameworks and sources.
Yeah, and I think it's a really interesting comment. And I would argue that it may be the job of the church in every generation.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, but we probably should break down a little bit what we mean by metaphysics.
I'm on the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy page, which is awesome.
It is a great, that actually is a great resource.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I mean, the internet can be a mixed bag sometimes, but the Stanford
almost all the time.
This is not sourced by Vladimir Putin.
There we go. This is from Stanford. Well, the best we know, it's not. Putin has
remember when Bush said, "Man, when I look into that man's eyes and I saw his soul." And McCain said, "The only thing I see when I look into the man's eyes are three letters, K, G, and B."
Oh my gosh.
He's a very good news source.
Yeah, it's very good.
So basically that we get the term, which as the Stanford Encyclopedia says, it's notoriously hard to define, but our first use of the term that we can find, I think historically, is about a century after Aristotle's death. An editor whose name is, in all probability, Andronicus of Rhodes, who I never learned about in philosophy, titled...
He was one of his middle Platonists.
Was he?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you know that, really?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm incredibly impressed.
Yeah, I don't remember anything he said, but I do remember he was part of the middle... Well, middle Platonism is a catch-all phrase for everything that happened between... after Aristotle to Plotinus. Yeah.
You know what's great? There's a secondary source on Plotinus I have on my shelf somewhere, but it's like one of the best first sentences I've ever heard in a book. Plotinus came up in an age that detested the body. And that's just like the first sentence. And I'm like, man, that's how you write a first sentence. It's short. It's succinct. It kind of sets the stage.
By the way, Plotinus is credited with beginning a movement that is called Neoplatonism. He was a philosopher and mystic, maybe a fellow student with Origen of Alexander. There's some debate about that, but they may have both studied under Ammonicus Saccius, I believe his name was. I'm going deep in those files there, but they studied under the same teacher. Actually, I argued once that maybe you could argue Origen is the father of Neoplatonism. But Neoplatonism, for the short answer, is a kind of a mystical form of Platonism that actually kind of merges some Aristotelian logic and categories with some Platonic framework. But it was a mystical approach to the world. And some people said it was a rival to Christianity.
Phil Carey, who's at Eastern and teaches philosophy, and runs the Honors College. I mean, he's given some great lectures on these topics, and he actually says that if you look at early Christianity compared over and against something like a lot of post-Platonic philosophy, especially the in the era of Plotinus and things, the Neoplatonism is much more spiritual. In the sense of concerned about the eternal,
it is very
the amaterial, the soul. Like if you compare it to, say, the Hebrew Bible, intensely more spiritual. Now, by spiritual, we mean connected to what sometimes is defined as timeless realities, non-physical realities.
Right.
So, I mean, and there's that tension there.
Yeah, and it is the pursuit to encounter the one, which it would be. I mean, what it is for Plato is one thing, that's open to debate, but for Plotinus, it's certainly some form of divinity.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, you know, one of the things, it might be helpful, again, we've already jumped into this.
Can I just give my Aristotle?
Yeah, give your metaphysics.
So basically, what Andronicus did is he took the last, the four names for the branch of philosophy that he said is metaphysics. Aristotle called first philosophy, first science, wisdom, and theology. So first philosophy, first science, wisdom, and theology. Now, it appears that Andronicus of Rhodes titled them metaphysics, maybe to say, read the physics first.
Right. It might have been just like the instructions in the Psalms for the choir director.
Right, exactly. Play this in B flat.
Play this in B flat. This is what comes next. This is what's after physics. Yeah.
So we could call it the subject matter of metaphysics could be defined as being as such, or the first cause of all things, or that which does not change. But you know, the the really real first principle. You know, there's lots of, but the study of ultimate reality, maybe right. we could say.
And, you know, every generation who does theology, and really theology is engaging with the Bible to make sense of it in your time. You know, I mean, it's, well, it's the living faith, all right? In other words, how do I make sense of this faith that I've been baptized into? And how do I read and interpret the Bible? And in spite of what some people may say, no one reads the Bible in a vacuum. So our worldview, our cosmology, our philosophical framework, even if you don't know you have a philosophical framework, you have one. It may be a kind of a patch quilt. Most of us in this time, we take a little bit from here and there. But nonetheless, we don't read the Bible in a vacuum. We bring different kind of philosophical worldviews to the text. There was a time, and particularly in the most critical times, when the doctrine of the Trinity and the doctrine of Christology was really being formulated in the 4th and 5th century, providentially, or whatever, however you want to say it, some of the best philosophical, theological minds that the church ever had were reflecting upon these very critical issues. Again, whether the time makes the people or the people make the time. And the language of Platonic philosophy, late Platonic philosophy, Neoplatonic philosophy, had an influence, a strong influence, in the way the Cappadocian fathers, who were the people that ultimately championed Athanasius' view of the Trinity, which is what we have in the Nicene Creed, and Augustine, who's really the father of not only Western Christianity, but one could strongly argue that Western civilization is formed through the baptized Platonism of Augustine.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think that, you know, Jensen says that the church fathers didn't so much try to Hellenize the gospel. What they tried to do was baptize or Christianize the antecedent religious impulses that was in the theology or philosophical theology of Plato, Aristotle, and who followed. I mean, one of the things that's important to note, I think, is that sort of Greco-Roman philosophy was theological, intensely theological.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting, particularly from the middle Platonic period, which is the period in which Christianity is born, up through late antiquity, philosophy was religious.
Pursuit. Yes, oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I always think about the pre-Socratic. If you're Socrates, you've made it, because there's a group of people that are pre you and post you. Yeah, I mean, for the folks coming in the wake of Socrates and after, both before and after, you could rightly call them demythologizers in the sense of the excesses of the mythology that was going on, centered around the Homeric deities, which in our first take we called humans behaving badly with really cool superpowers.
That's right.
Oftentimes the gods are worse than human beings. They're sort of like,
exaggerated. So they have everything we have in excess.
Is it the myth of Glycon or whatever in the Republic where they're talking about what would you do if you get the invisible ring and sweat the invisible man is based on? You'd become this tyrannical person and you become. So like on some level, it's the Homeric deities seem to be what happens when you get the ring, except not just becoming invisible, you get all sorts of other cool superpowers. But the Greco-Roman philosophical tradition that, again, in the wake of before and after Socrates, is trying to say, hey, there's a better way at thinking about ultimate truth and the good life and the nature of the human condition than these Homeric myths. I mean, there's got to be. And we've got to study, we got to do this through critical reflection. And I think what the early church fathers had in common with that philosophical tradition was the revulsion at pagan deities, which were primitive, didn't inspire any forms of the good life, either ethically or intellectually. And so that's where I think where the symbiotic relationship develops.
You may say it already happened in Judaism. I mean, in many ways, the rabbinic method is a Socratic method. And why Judaism was attractive to many people in the Common Era, or the first century, and the century in which Christianity is born, was because they seemed to, from antiquity, get to the one God. I mean, one can argue that polytheism is really somewhere underneath all that polytheism. There's a monism, or there's a single deity. And in the ancient world, antiquity was respected. So new and improved was not attractive. You know, old and proven was. And the fact that from antiquity, from pre-Socratic history or pre-Homeric history, the Jews had believed in one God. There was this kind of this amazing convergence that really was a wonderful hotbed for the birth of the Christian faith.
Yeah, and I think that one thing Judaism has in common, right, with Platonic traditions is there's a creator creation distinction to some, yes, you know, to a stronger degree in Judaism probably than at least later Judaism than you find, but it's there, like.
Well, it's not there in a metaphysical way, but in the prohibition against idolatry from the beginning, you can see once Judaism encounters Hellenism, then you can see it really is a natural marriage.
And the genderlessness of the God of Israel,
yes,
that there's not, that the creation is not from he and his consort.
In spite of the King James Version.
Exactly. Yeah.
So anyways, to sum that
by way of prologue.
And so I think it's helpful as you're listening to this, metaphysics can be seen as the worldview, the philosophical worldview one brings to the biblical text and the Christian faith.
Yeah, what you think is really real.
So that's having done that definition and jumped all over historically. By the way, I think what Augustine and the Cappadocians do for Plato, what Aquinas did for Aristotle, Jonathan Edwards did for Locke.
Oh, absolutely.
But the trouble is, the philosophical was changing so much. I think if Jonathan Edwards, if time had been a little slower, if philosophical progress had moved a little slower, Jonathan Edwards, we might include him in the pantheon there of people who took the philosophical concepts of their time. And again, you have to understand Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century is dealing with the revival of Aristotle, the Aristotle that's been
rediscovered.
Which
was declared heretical. Because part of the reason it was declared heretical was Aristotle thought unless you could define something with limits, you can't study its being. Like if something was infinite, you couldn't discuss. So you had to talk about the first mover, first cause. You had to be able to circumscribe. No, I mean, much bigger than anything in reality, but if you, that's the problem. If you make that move with Aristotle, everybody thought, well, then theology's done, because it means you can't really have knowledge of an infinite being.
Or the other thing that they got in trouble with is they sometimes, some parts of Aristotle talks about the eternal nature of history, time.
Oh, yeah, because creation is not,
So it's kind of, it's ongoing, but it was funny. In the 13th century, what the Islamic world had from the 6th and 7th century, Western Europe just rediscovered, bits and pieces in the 11th and 12th centuries and 13th centuries. And so there would be years where at the same time, there'd be a papal bull that would say, you can't study Aristotle. And then papal universities advertising, come here and study Aristotle.
Yeah. When they were considering, after they were calling Aquinas a heretic, and then like a century later or so, right, they're considering canonizing him. And there was a question about the miracles. I forget which pope said, I can show you where they are. They're on every page of the Summa.
Exactly. And the Christian humanist, people not just like Calvin, but others, They put Aristotle and Plato in heaven.
Yeah. So Zwingli put Hercules there too.
Zwingli. There's one other reason not to reject Zwingli, but
one other. I mean, just many.
But anyway, so to get back, metaphysics is your worldview. It has a strong philosophical history, and part of the critique over the years of say the Nicene Creed and the Chalcedon Creed or early Christianity or medieval Christianity, that it was overly driven by philosophy, and that is a little bit of the rhetoric of the Reformation.
Yes,
Even though they were driven by philosophy as well, but it was a different philosophy. Maybe not so much Luther, but certainly Calvin was.
Yeah, and I think...
And Zwingli as well, yeah.
One of the things where you see this put into relief is the reformers, with their insistence, rightly, that we need a more biblical understanding of the nature and being of God. But they're still so dependent on some of the philosophical tradition that actually... The problem becomes more pronounced with some of the reformers.
Because it does,
In the dilution of the medieval synthesis.
Absolutely.
And Jansen in the interview also said he thought that was one of the biggest problems in the history of the church, because with the dilution of the medieval synthesis, you separate the natural knowledge from the supernatural knowledge, and then eventually get skeptical, and you just care about the natural knowledge.
Right, and the medieval synthesis is really a Thomistic synthesis. You could say everybody after Thomas, who didn't follow Thomas, tried to undo that. And that was actually, that was part of, and Martin Luther, by the way, went to the schools that were known for instance, the theology that tried to that took away that synthesis. So you have this radically independent God. Matter of fact, I think extreme Calvinist, keeps the late medieval God, and that the late medieval God is so independent and so free that if tomorrow God decided that good was evil, God could do that.
Yeah. Is that kind of like extreme nominalism?
Yeah. And that actually, I mean, that's the worldview of Zwingli. And then one could argue maybe Calvin a little bit as well.
I also like that Zwingli, before the Reformation, just as he was a priest, just said to his bishop, look, I'm not going to make it celibate. I'll try not to have a bunch of kids or anything and be careful, but I'm just not going to, this is just not going to happen.
Yeah, he did get married secretly a few months before he became a reformer. Yeah, that's true.
So this is from Colin Gunton's, I'm actually quoting from Clement, but he's quoting Clement of Alexandria.
Who was he was an important, he was actually a great middle Platonist.
Yeah, second century, right? Look at that. I got that right on the first try. Here he's talking about a perhaps dangerous tendency in the tradition. You see it this early, second century. He's talking about the relationship of the Old Testament to Christ and philosophy to Christ for the Greeks. Perchance, too, philosophy was given to the Greeks directly and primarily till the Lord should call the Greeks, for this was a schoolmaster to bring the Hellenic mind, as the law was for the Hebrews, to Christ. Philosophy, therefore, was a preparation, paving the way for him who is perfected in Christ. And then Gunton says, in that passage, the Old Testament is implicitly downgraded in two ways. Narrowed to its function, it is important for the New Testament far more than is suggested by the one allusion to a saying of Paul to be found there, and relativized by being reduced, or at least in this respect, to an equality of function with the philosophy of the Greeks. The distortion finds its way into the mainstream of the Western tradition in words contained in the Requiem, Teste David et Cilibia. We encounter a juxtaposition in parallel of Old Testament and pagan philosophy, which surely should not be.
Well, here is a positive thing to say about what Clement's project was and a negative thing. On one sense, and I've never been able to find who said this first, and I don't know anyone. If you know who said this first, send us the reference.
Absolutely.
But the idea that all truth is God's truth. It would make sense if Clement said that, but I don't remember reading it in Clement. But Clement's project certainly would say all truth is God's truth. Okay. That's the positive thing.
Absolutely.
The negative thing in this, in the second century, first of all, we had the Bar Kokhba revolt, where over probably 1 million+ Jews were killed. A whole Roman legion was wiped out by the Jewish revolt. And this really was probably the, I mean, there are vestiges of Jewish Christian churches. You know, we see some of the vestiges into the 5th century, but this is a death knell. And there were a lot of good reasons for Christians, who by now are vastly majority Gentile movement, to distance themselves from the Jewish antecedents. And I think that's one dynamic. Also, Jews and Christians are competing against each other in the public square. There are actually disputations going on, debates about between Jews and Gentiles as to, or Jews and Christians as to what's the truth. And if you read Tertullian, for instance, and from other sources, it seems like the Jews frequently won those public debates. So that's a little bit of the backdrop there. You know, again, anti-Semitism has not yet been born in the church. You have to see it in the second century. Jews and Christians are competing, rival versions of what Christians claim is the same history, only they are saying that we are the right version of it. So that's a little bit of the backdrop of what Clement is doing.
You're on fire today. This is like me talking about comic books. Like you're on point today, my friend.
You have touched deep into the recesses of my memory.
I'm into this. This is great. So I think, you know, another thing that Gunton points out, well, two things, I think, that, and then maybe we'll get back to Jensen, but he says that, he quotes Charles Hodge saying this, that there's one place in the first part of his systematic theology entitled Theology Proper, where he says, theism is the doctrine of an extra mundane personal God, the creator, preserver, and governor of the world. And then the second quote, which Gunton wants to quote at greater length, appears about 150 pages later. Probably the best definition of God ever penned by man is that given in the Westminster Catechism. God is a spirit, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. This is a true definition, for it states the class of beings to which God is to be referred. He is spirit, and he is distinguished from all other spirits, and that he is infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in his being, and perfection. It is also a complete definition insofar as it is an exhaustive statement of the contents of our idea of God. And then Gunton's commentary is, it is not that we should necessarily want to deny the attribution of most of the qualities of these qualities to God, nor is it that I am unaware of the fact that Hodge delimits carefully what he means by definition. He has elsewhere much more to say about God. It is rather a matter of what is left out, in particular what Robert Latham has recently pointed out, that Hodge does not get around to suggesting that God is triune until after 250 pages of detailed exposition of the doctrine of God. Of theological dissatisfaction, Gunton says, with this, volumes could be written.
All right. So British. So you're saying, yeah, Hodge is pseudo-Dionysius.
Well, yeah. This is the problem, where when you let loose on your understanding of God, adopting uncritically from what Jensen says, is we have to understand Christianity always in its missionary encounters analyzes, reflects at its best, dialogues with the religious traditions it finds itself in. But, you know, Jensen points out these are religious traditions.
Right.
They're not neutral. It's not natural. It's not science. It's not like, but Jensen's fear is we've baptized them.
Right.
And as a result, oftentimes we've come up with a less than baptized understanding of God. Because if God, because if you think like these terms, which you wouldn't need necessarily the Bible to get any of that. I mean, you could get that from certain Hellenistic speculation.
Well, and the interesting thing is that, and I think Calvinism has a particular tendency to go down this road, because they talk about the absolute sovereignty of God in ways that have very little to do with biblical understandings of election, and it has very little to do with really how we see God presented in God's fullness in the text. It's really interesting, because I think the God of the hyper Calvinist is really not that far from the Stoic God, or a little bit Manichaean at times. It's really interesting. I listened to music, and was one of those Christian music stations where they're doing pop songs, you know, which is like the absolute worst combination. But I lingered long enough to hear, you know, "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas." Through the years, we'll always be together if the fates permit. That's how the Christian version said, through the years, we'll always be together if the Lord permits. And I go, no, in other words, this is what's not going on with the Christian faith in terms of
insert Lord here.
Oh, my heavens. You know, the idea is the Lord is not to be equated with fatalism, but people tend to, it's a natural tendency. For whatever reason, fatalism gives people comfort, and I think a lot of times what people call providence is actually a pagan fatalism, but that's another podcast. So let's shift a little bit to the contemporary time, because, I mean, you know, what is our metaphysics? And in the original version of this, you know, I think, for instance, the therapeutic model of the human being has become the metaphysics of the contemporary church.
I do think that Nietzsche is right on almost everything, at least prophetically. I mean, maybe not normatively, but as
rhetorically.
Far as,
that's okay. Let's get him rhetorical.
And as he predicts things, I mean, like, he's just a predictor of trends.
Yeah.
And he said that psychology would replace theology as the queen of the science. And that has happened. I mean, I feel like that's almost indisputable. It doesn't matter what field you're in. Like, if you're in evolutionary biology, you're talking right. about so psychology, it doesn't matter. Right. If you're in philosophy, it doesn't matter. If you're in history. And I mean, and I'm not necessarily saying it's the worst thing in the world, but it just is the case. I think that psychology is so much of how we transact
right.
and self-understanding and understanding of others, I mean, hands down.
When I was trying to teach worldview, or at least philosophy, trying to give people intro metaphysics, you know, and in my church history classes, because most people don't have a background in this, and that's unfortunate, because you kind of need to know some philosophy to do theology, like a lot of philosophy.
And you had the benefit of studying with Diogenes Allen at Princeton,
who was
one of the greats at this. Yes, at this at building the bridge,
right.
And creating the relationship necessary.
And also being a church historian, you just to make sense of it. I mean, I had to backfill my philosophy heavy duty when I was in seminary and in my doctoral work. But with my students, I used to say, okay, how many of you think that God wants you to have a good self-image? And everybody would raise their hand. Okay. And then I would say, and this is a Baptist seminary, at least it's kind of, it was affiliated with the Baptist, American Baptist.
Baptist-ish.
Ish, yeah. Emphasis on ish. But I would say, and then I would say, okay, where in the Bible does it teach that? And of course, nobody could come up with a Bible verse, but we have the psychological idea of what it means to be well. I mean, in other words, we've replaced shalom, you know, if you would, the Hebrew idea that some of the early church seems to hold on to, with this idea of self-actualization, of feeling good about yourself. You know, the 20th century, which has, you know, been brought into the 21st century model of what psychological health is really the new metaphysics. I was a psychology major undergraduate and did some graduate stuff in as well. The good news is that kind of is coherent. You know, when, you know, so much of what we get in preaching across the country is, you know, therapeutic in its approach. The good news is that's where people are. The bad news is, there are volumes written of every psychological theory that disproves the theory. And so, matter of fact, serious psychology people are trying to become neuropsychologists. You know, they're trying to study the brain because they want to become more science. There's a reason in most universities the psychology department was put in the buildings where the religion department used to be. They're not the best buildings on campus because it is a pseudoscience at best, unless you're dealing with the pure neurological brain stuff. That's what it is at best. And the same weaknesses that it has as a science or an approach to life gets carried into all those preachers and theologies that try to merge the two things.
Well, or more positively, we could say it might resemble philosophy more than it resembles hard sciences, which doesn't mean it's not efficacious or helpful, but it doesn't mean that it's different than an experiment that is repeated with a super collider.
Right. Well, I would just like my study of philosophy has been greatly helpful in my own theological formation. My background in psychology has been very helpful in the kind of spiritual direction and counseling I've done over the years in a wide range of areas as a pastor. So I am thankful for the major, but I have a strong sense of the limitations of the discipline.
Well, let me throw in a little more Jensen, you know, as we begin to wind down. It's a long podcast, bro.
That's all right.
I mean, I think it's it fits the subject matter. Here's a statement from Jensen on Karl Barth. Barth did not declare independence from the philosophers because philosophy is something so different from theology that it must be kept at arm's length. His reason was exactly the opposite. He refused to depend on the official philosophers because what they offered to do for him, he thought he should do for himself in conversation with them when that seemed likely to help. The Kirchliche Dogmatik, or the Church Dogmatics, is an enormous attempt to interpret all reality by the fact of Christ. Indeed, it can be read as the first truly major system of Western metaphysics since the collapse of Hegelianism.
Wow.
I think that that's insightful.
Right. And I think theology at its best has always been Christocentric. I mean, Augustine is a Christocentric theologian. Calvin, the earlier editions of the Institute, I think, were better because they were more Christocentric. In other words, Christ is the center. I mean, that's why we are Christians, and that should be the lens by which we look at things. And, you know,
and Christ as a Jew, it makes Israel centric too. I mean, like,
yes, absolutely.
I think is, like, you know, for all their greatness, the two of the great treatises on the incarnation, Athanasius on the Incarnation in the 4th century and Anselm Cur Deus Homo, you know, why did God become man, in the 12th century? 1100s.
He overlapped.
Okay.
It might be the early 12th century.
Yeah, there you go. I almost got 2 dates right.
Yeah, you're good. That's good.
I get better right around 1800 or something. I get a little better on certain days.
It starts getting a little fuzzy once we get out of American history for me.
Neither of their understandings of the reconciliation wrought by God in Christ require the Old Testament to work.
Right. No.
Jesus could have been a Mexican, Chinese, from Chicago, Canadian, you know, from Norway or Zimbabwe. So there's not a preservation of the uniqueness. So to say it's Christocentric is also Israel-centric.
Right. Yeah. No,
because
absolutely.
Jesus is first the Messiah of Israel, Christ, and then the world.
I try often. Christ is such a part of my language and my piety. I do when I'm in teaching and preaching, I try to always translate that Messiah just to kind of keep that connection. And I think because if you have a Christocentric approach to a worldview, you know, we believe that that's, you know, heaven and earth are in a strange, you know, encounter there in a way that it never, you know, in a way that's unique. I mean, I think Bonhoeffer somewhere in his Ethics says that the incarnation changes everything.
Yeah.
God becoming human changes everything, which is very appropriate on this Saturday before Advent. And, you know, this, as we've been talking about this metaphysical, I started reading earlier and I picked it up earlier this fall, and I picked it up again last night, an amazing book. It's called When Breath Becomes Air. And it was written by the late Paul Kalanithi, I think is how you pronounce his name.
I've heard of this book.
It's an amazing book. It makes the top 100 of New York Times notable books for this year and of 2016. And it's published posthumously. He dies. He's in his late 30s. He's a brilliant neurosurgeon. And in his last year, he never gets to quite practice his medicine because he's still in study in preparation. He develops, lung cancer, and he dies from it. And so he's writing this memoir as he knows he's dying, which makes it even more poignant. And one of the things a couple different times, and he's a deeply spiritual man. He's Catholic, and he brings that spirituality. Matter of fact, he said, if I had figured this out earlier, I may have been a minister or, you know, a priest, he said. But why he became a neurosurgeon is because he said, I want to know what really matters. And he talks about this incident. He's looking at this incident through the lenses of knowing that he's dying. And he says, you know, I wish I just, you know, if I have one regret I have, I wish I could have been constantly more present to my patients. But as a neurosurgeon, he says, I need to understand the gravity of what I'm doing here. Because when I'm talking to people before we do the surgery, I'm dealing with who they really are. And if you would be, I'm touching their very souls. And I don't know if he used the word holy, but he used the word that's a holy thing that I hold. And what's interesting to me, the old metaphysics of, you know, the body being a, you know, the soul and the body, the spirit body being different, has some real problems, at least in this where we're at right now, in terms of when it comes to looking at what happens with, you know, brain activity, you know, what we can even see what happens in a brain when people are praying or meditating. So we're learning more about what it really makes us to be human. There's on one level, what makes us human, our personality, what we used to call our soul, is one part electrical you know, electrical transmissions that are going on within the gray matter. It's a physiological, it is a material process. Now, what's beautiful about this book is I think, you know, and I would encourage it because I think he is approaching this highly specialized physical science from what I would call a metaphysical approach. He's not reducing. In other words, just because he knew what makes people tick, he knew what part of the brain, what things were going to happen, but he didn't reduce the human being to merely that. And I think in some levels, the Christocentric project of Barth, or of any good theology that was a corrective in the 20th century, I think it really has set the table for us to recapture, you know, really what does it mean for spirituality to have flesh and blood around it.
Yeah, and that is the power of the incarnation, right? And this is one of Jensen's biggest concerns, is that if God is opposed to time in an adversarial way, if what divinity means is to be without time, then how do you say that God became human, which, I mean, time is so much at the heart of who we are. It's one of the reasons we have the church calendar, because time, how we perceive reality, is so shaped by how we mark time. One last short Jensen quote, which I think is relevant to what you just said. The fathers did not, as it is still often supposed, Hellenize the evangel or the gospel. They didn't like make it Greco-Roman. They labored to evangelize their own antecedent Hellenism and succeeded remarkably, if not fully. And so I think that Jen sees, you know, there's still some unbaptized antecedent religious impulses and philosophical perspectives. And I think that's always the right move, right? Like if we don't try to sort of psychologize the gospel or take whatever current metaphysical trend and put it, what we do try to do is from the interior mystery and yet rationality of the Christ event, the good news, the gospel, then we look and see what truths we find out there in psychology or science or neuroscience, that we don't let those things define the mystery of the gospel, but through the mystery of the gospel, we see the mysterious truths that are reflected even outside of it.
Yeah. You know, we often talk about it as we, you know, as we look at Luke chapter 2 and that account of the birth of Jesus, it's raw. You know, you've got shepherds, it's in a cave. You have a young woman giving birth, surrounded by, you know, the cold, and it's you know, he puts it in historical context and rains and things like that. And we romanticize it, but it's a messy entering of God into history. I would argue, on a metaphysical level, when the writer of John, you know, says the Logos became flesh, it's hard to know. You can't know his intent, but because that word is so loaded, and because I think of the underlying sophistication of the thought in John's gospel, the Greek is primitive, but the thinking is profound. I think he takes metaphysics and makes it messy. In some levels, it's a metaphysical move that moves metaphysical reality into a manure-surrounded cave as well.
And like Mary, we should ponder those things in our heart.
Amen.
Many years ago, he looked out through a glassless window. All that he could see was Babylon. Beautiful green fields and dreams. He learned to measure the stars, but there was a worry in his heart. He said, time. Yeah. the same when you open the vein. Sometimes it was faith, power, and reason as the cornerstone.